Welcome to Gripecast with your host, Alex Hernandez. This show is dedicated to consumer technology news and pop culture. Gripecast is owned by TechHarris. Visit TechHarris.com for the latest tech reviews, news, entertainment, and pop culture. Now sit tight, the show is about to begin. Hey, hey, welcome guys. Welcome to Gripecast episode one. It's been a week since episode zero, and here we are with our second episode, technically our first episode, but we're back, and hopefully we got some good content here for you. I reached out to some folks at MeWe, some of our readers, and just asked questions. What do you guys want me to talk about? I'll be posting those on MeWe, questionnaire asking what you guys want to hear me talking about. So I got a few responses, and that's what we're going to cover today. I wanted to give you a quick update on the site. We kind of have remained the same. Nothing has changed quite. You know, there's not much change in anything. Google's still up to their shenanigans, and Google's still giving us some new parameters within to work with. So we're doing our best though, and I do appreciate everyone that comes to visit TechHarris.com and check out our tech reviews and news. All the traffic we can get, we appreciate you guys supporting independent media and supporting the site, especially our site. Help us to continue pushing this forward. I really do appreciate that. But let's get right into it. Carbon Copy Man over on MeWe, who I do talk to on occasion in DMs, wants to know what I think of Apple Vision Pro. He knows what I think of it. Well, we've discussed it, and I know what he thinks of it. So my thoughts on AR, VR, Apple Vision Pro, spatial computing, you know, this whole... a lot of marketing buzzwords, right? Spatial computer. It says right now, if you're watching on YouTube or on Rumble or on MeWe, you will see that I have the article pulled up from their newsroom. It says, introducing Apple Vision Pro, Apple's first spatial computer. All right. So what is a spatial computer? Well, this is essentially a headset you put on your face, and you can project your computing environment within that visual space in your right in front of you. So it, you know, kind of looks like things are floating there, right? I mean, it's not anything new. We've had this with MetaQuest and with Vive. Just slightly different here, of course, with Apple. Apple likes to do things their own way, and this is evident here. First, let me say that I do think that Apple's version of VR, AR is quite a bit better than what we currently have, though I don't think it's better for gaming. I'm not a huge AR, VR person. I don't have a MetaQuest. I don't have a Vive. I've used AR and VR in the past, in previous years, but nothing to really make me an expert. But we all have opinions, right? I think that gaming, in from what I see on the Apple Vision Pro, isn't nearly as good as, say, Meta or some of the other options out there. I'm sure they'll improve it. But from a productivity standpoint, from getting work done, it looks like, you know, this is a viable option for those that want to go this route. So I don't discount or dismiss Apple Vision Pro. I think there's a place for it, but I think it's still really niche, and I'm not sure that it's going to come out of that niche market space. I think that it might continue to be in that niche market space, and if anything, it might find a space within business for certain tasks. but for the average consumer, I am not sure that this is a solution that is viable as of yet. I give it credit for pushing the space and making expanding on what's already been done. But for me, AR and VR are just not ready for prime time. And I am, on a personal level, not sure that I even want AR or VR for myself. It's not just not something that I'm comfortable with. There've already been reports about, you know, nausea and headaches and just being generally uncomfortable wearing a headset like this, even though they've tried to make it as comfortable as possible. I did talk to my brother, who is a big AR VR guy, and he talks about his Meta and how I think he has the Vive. One of them, I can't remember which one he has, but he talks about his headset and how it gets uncomfortable even after about 45 minutes to an hour. So for this to be a viable thing on a consumer level, there's got to be better comfort, less instances of being sick, headaches, nausea, and all that kind of deal. So for me, Apple Vision Pro is a no-go. I see it as a niche product right now. It's first generation tech for Apple. And like with all first generation tech, it's going to have its growing pains. I mean, it's like foldable displays, you know, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. You know, we're 5-6 generations into a foldable display for phones. And they're still sort of niche. It's not a regular thing. But we'll get more into foldable displays in a minute. For the Apple Vision Pro, you know, I'm scrolling through here. If you're watching, you see the gestures that they have and the interface. From what I'm told, the on-screen keyboard isn't very comfortable to type on. Yes, you can use a hardware keyboard, but what's the point? If you want to do AR, VR, you want to do everything virtually. So why am I having to get a piece of hardware to interact with my virtual $4,000 headset? So I think there's a lot to get through with Apple Vision Pro, a lot to get through with AR, VR. It's come quite a ways, and I just think that we're still several years out from this even being something business would use. I think that we're going to be seeing more of a business use case in the end, kind of like Google Glass ended up being, though that ended up being retired ultimately. But you saw where Google Glass went. It started off as trying to be a consumer product and ended up being a business product. It still failed. So I don't wish failure on Apple or Apple Vision Pro or Meta or any of those. Hey, if they can make the product that a consumer wants and the business wants, great. But for me personally, AR, VR is not where it's at. It's not something I'll adopt anytime soon. You know, things can change and tech can change. And, you know, come back to me in 5 years, 2 or 3, 5 years, and we'll find out if I still have the same opinion. So there you go, Carbon Copy Man. All right, Tim. Tim, he asks, why do smart TVs have so little memory? So if you're not aware, smart TVs do have memory in them. Most of that memory is dedicated to the operating system and to the apps that you install. But they don't generally come with, you know, gigabytes or of memory. You know, I think what he means is storage, not so much like RAM, but storage memory. So they don't come with a lot of storage. I see where he's going with this. I understand why you would want, some people would want some more storage, more memory. You can store your movies on board the television itself. But I don't see that the average consumer really does that, where they're going to plug in a USB drive or some sort of drive to download movies onto the actual TV. I feel like TVs are kind of a consumable these days. They don't tend to stick around that long. So that said, I get where you're going, Tim. I can see the use for having more memory, more storage space in your on your smart television. I could see why you would want it, so you can put your movies and other content, pictures and stuff on it, so you can access it through the interface. Totally get it. But I don't think that the market supports that. So I think you're one of the few people that might want that. Most people are streaming movies now. Most people are, casting from their phones for pictures and video. So adding more storage to the television is, you know, it's not going to really benefit the majority of people. And it'll run the cost up a little bit more on televisions, which are already expensive as it is. All right. I hope that answers your question, Tim. Appreciate it. All right, moving on. Michael, one of our readers over here in MeWe, he says he wants me to talk about HP sabotaging their printer business by forcing subscriptions. And I did a little research on that. I already knew HP has had a subscription model for its printers and for its printer ink. And I know they make it a heck of a process to use anything other than HP ink. I believe there's a way to do that, but it's not easy. I pulled up this article from Tom's Guide. It says HP begins subscription plans for its printers and ink up to $36 per month, includes limits and cancellation fees. All right. It says in January, HP said it would bring subscription plans for its printers and tried to justify blocking third-party links. Now, HP has implemented the subscription, calling it an all-in plan, where users can print a limited amount of pages per month for a monthly fee, provided they sign up with a two-year commitment and other charges. This plan will include the printer and the cartridge ink, with the promise of next business day printer replacement and the option to upgrade the printer after 2 years. At the time of writing, HP allows you to choose three printers, the Envy, which costs $6.99 a month, the Inspire for $8.99, and the Offset Pro, which costs $12.99. For its customers, the minimum number of pages you can print is up to 20 pages per month and goes up to 100 pages per month for $10.99 per month on Envy. The most expensive plan is the OfficeJet Pro, which restricts you to up to 700 pages per month for $36. You'll be charged a dollar per 15 pages if you print more than your limit, and this does not include taxes. Yeah, I mean, I know there's ways to get around the HP printer ink deal, but I agree with Michael in some respects here that, you know, I have an HP printer, and I am on the HP Instant Ink plan. I had two HP printers, and I decided to stop using the black and white one that I had, and so I canceled the Instant Ink subscription on that one, and I was sent an email warning me that I would no longer be able to use my printer if I canceled the subscription. So in even the cartridge that I have that's brand new would not work. So, yeah, HP is doing some funky things there with their printers and their model, their ink model. I gotta say that I have issues with printers. I hate printers. I've done tech work for people. I've repaired laptops and desktops, and I've done a lot of things like that. One request a lot of people have asked of me, you know, that I know in my personal life here is, can you fix my printer? I'm like, no, go buy a new printer. just forget about fixing the printer and buying new printers are awful. It's probably the worst piece of tech on planet Earth. So I hate printers. So hopefully, Michael, I am answering your question here. I agree with you. I think that whatever HP is doing with this printer model and ink model, it's a little bit underhanded in some ways. But you see how they make the most amount of money they can is from printer ink. They're practically giving away the printers. It's the refillable printer ink cartridges that's where their bread and butter is. So they do not want to let go of that. And they're not going to do that anytime soon, I don't think. All right. So foldable displays. I had a conversation with someone online and saw a comment from them on one of my other social platforms talking about my recent review of the Lenovo ThinkPad X1 Fold 16, which is a 16.3-inch foldable laptop. I gave it a generally positive review with some, you know, kind of, it needs work. It's expensive. I don't think it's for the average consumer. I think it's a more of a business-focused laptop. It's definitely not a gaming machine. And I think that content creators aren't going to really get into this either. I think what Lenovo's doing with this particular model is, I'll say that it's an improvement over their 13.3 X1 Fold, which I reviewed several years ago, by leaps and bounds. And so I think that's a good thing. But I don't think that this laptop, this particular laptop, is ready for consumer use. I think it's a business niche business product. I think that business users who want a folding laptop that breaks down to a small footprint where they can just slip it in quick and be able to run and gun, that it works, but they have to have the budget to buy that. Because it is expensive. The unit we had in for review, I think I clocked in almost $5,000. And you can find many more laptops that have way better specs internally that will work for you in content creation and even gaming. They're half the price or less than half the price. So my thoughts on at least on the X1 Fold 16 are that I like where Lenovo's going with it, but it's not ready for the average consumer. Now, on folding displays, now I've been bullish on folding displays. I think foldable displays there's a future for foldable displays somewhere, whether that's in mobile or in devices like laptops and tablets. That's a different conversation, but I've been bullish on folding displays. I think that they'll be around for quite a while in some form. The comment on social media was concerning the Fold 16, talking how they kind of mentioned that the folding display feels like it's 3D printed. You know, it feels cheap, doesn't feel high quality. And I wanted to address that. There's just some things about folding displays that do make them quite a bit less premium looking than a glass display. Because what you have to understand is there's two layers to the displays on your laptop and on your phone. There's the lower inner display that's displaying that has the content on it, you know, the images and everything else that goes across your display. And then there's the outer display, which is glass, which is, you know, it's touch sensitive so that you can interact with the bottom display. And that glass top layer is what protects that inner display because that's really paper thin. So what they did with folding displays is they took that same bottom layer that's displaying the content and information. And they use that, but above that, the glass display is no longer this thick glass that you're used to on laptops and mobile phones. It's a lot thinner. And that glass is the part that really is the tech, where the tech is, that it's able to fold and not break. So because of how thin that glass is, yes, I agree that it feels and looks not very high quality. I don't know how they're going to address that and how they'll make that better, but I just wanted to explain that to that commenter, that I don't think that the product is any less high quality. I think it's the quality it can, the highest quality it can be for what it is. And I think that because of how thin it is, that's why I think you perceive it to be less quality than what you're used to. But foldable displays, I am totally bullish on foldable displays. I think that we're in for more devices from other companies. More brands are going to be making foldable displays. There's a rumor that Apple's coming out with a foldable 20.1 inch MacBook Pro or something. And we're looking at, I think that the timeline for that was something like 2026 or 2027 is what the rumor is. So yeah, I don't think foldable displays are going anywhere. I think they're here to stay. I may not be in mobile devices, but for certain in laptop and tablet form, I think they'll be here. All right. Let's get moving on here. Somebody, I didn't write down the name, and I apologize for that. Somebody wanted me to talk about Roku's mandatory terms of service update, which I didn't do a whole lot of research on. I pulled this up this morning. I was just kind of glancing over it. But Roku issues a mandatory terms of service update that you must agree to, or you can't use your Roku. Well, that's just a crock of bull. Over the last 48 hours, Roku has slowly been rolling out a mandatory update to its terms of service. In this terms, it changes the dispute resolution terms, but is not clear exactly why. When the new terms and conditions message shows up on a Roku player TV, your only option is to accept them or turn off your Roku and stop using it. In an email to customers, Roku says, "We want to let you know that we have made our changes to our dispute resolution terms, which describes how you can resolve disputes with Roku. We encourage you to read the updated dispute resolution terms by continuing to use our products and services. You agree to these updated terms. Thank you for making Roku part of your entertainment experience." It does say Roku does offer a way to opt out of these new arbitration rules if you write them a letter to an address listed in the terms of service. Wow. A letter. You do need to hurry, though, as you only get 30 days to write a letter to Roku to opt out, though it's unclear if that is from when you buy your Roku or agree to these new terms. Yeah, that's not cool. That's what I have to say about that. There should be an opt-out on screen. Should be an opt-out in the email. There should be just a real simple way to opt out and not have to deal with writing a letter to Roku to opt out of the service. Seems a little underhanded. I haven't read the terms and conditions, so I don't use Roku, so it doesn't really affect me. But yeah, sorry for those that have to deal with this. All I gotta say is switch to Google TV or Apple TV, one of those two. I prefer Apple TV. Apple TV is really the only interface right now that does not have any sort of advertising. So you get Google TV or any other streaming or interface like that, streaming box, you're going to have advertising. All right, guys, that is what I have this week for Gripecast Episode 1. I hope you enjoyed this. And we have a new feature, actually. I wanted to announce this here. As soon as this podcast is over, if you want to head over to MeWe on our MeWe page at Tech Aris, there will be some exclusive content for you on MeWe and for MeWe users only. So we'll end this podcast here, and then we will be jumping on over to MeWe, and you can catch the rest of it there. Have a great one.